Hi, I'm Alex, and welcome to the Stock Stories Podcast. This is the podcast where we decode investing principles by analyzing the businesses behind the stock, as well as looking at mental models in order to help you become a better investor. Let's go. Welcome to the show. This is the Stock Stories Podcast. And yes, my name is Alex. I'm your host and stock storyteller for today. Thank you so much for joining me. This is the show where we decode businesses and mental models. So thank you again for joining me. Got a great show for you today. I hope you've been enjoying the last few episodes. We've been going through a lot of real estate investment trusts, and I want to continue that series. So last week we talked about a company called Federal Realty. I really enjoyed studying that company. I think it's a pretty great company. Could be a good opportunity depending on how you see the retail outlook in certain markets moving forward. So if you haven't listened to that episode yet, go ahead and check that one out first. If you have already and you're just hungry for more, well, let's just get into it today. We're going to talk about another real estate investment trust, yet another one that's also in the S&P 500. And instead of focusing on, retail specific businesses that are more so converting to mixed use properties, we're going to talk about an entirely different niche in the real estate investment trust arena that was entirely new to me. I had heard of this kind of company before, but never actually studied it. So it was really interesting, and I hope you enjoy the research I put together and my thoughts. So let's go ahead and talk about Digital Realty. All right, today we're going to talk about Digital Realty, and that's ticker symbol DRT. So what is Digital Realty? Well, what we'd like to do on these episodes, if you're new to the show, is first talk about the history of the company, kind of understand where they come from, and then look at the current business model as well as financials, and then move on from there to talk about a little bit about valuation and some closing thoughts I have based on my analysis. So first of all, what is Digital Realty? In simple terms, what does this company do and how does it make money? Remember, if we can't answer this question first, then all the other work that we do to try to understand a business or a stock, it's kind of for naught, right? It doesn't make any difference if we don't understand essentially how the business makes money. So let's start with that. Digital Realty buys and operates buildings that house data centers. Now, if you're unfamiliar with what data centers are, these are physical locations where computer systems are stored. So companies basically pay Digital Realty to store data for them and to route data between different places. And we'll get into all the details of that in a moment. But first, let's talk about the history of the company. So Digital Realty was initially formed out of the consolidation of some assets from a private equity firm, a firm called GI Partners. And what they did was they purchased about 21 data centers from bankruptcy auctions, and they started packaging them together. They put a management team in place and they formed this new company and called it Digital Realty. Now, this was around the 2003 timeframe. Now, they sold out part of their position by taking the company public in 2004 in an IPO, and at that time, the company had 23 data centers. So that's kind of how they started out as a public company. Now, over time, the private equity firm kind of relinquished their position and exited the position fully. So they gradually sold their shares until they were completely out by 2007. Now, over the course of the next several years after going public, the company began to acquire additional data centers around the country. So they started with a few data centers and they started buying them throughout America. So, for example, places like Arizona, Massachusetts, Philly, Connecticut, etc. So they started expanding geographically, but the bulk of their properties started in, I believe it was the Virginia, Northern Virginia area. Another big milestone for the company was in 2015, they purchased a company called Telex, and that's spelled T-E-L-X, and that's another large data center firm, and they bought that for about $1.8 billion. And this was a big move because it doubled the company's size. Now, usually when companies are making acquisitions when they're smaller, it's a lot easier to grow quickly through acquisition just by the nature that you're a smaller company and there are a lot of smaller or small-ish companies that are around your size that you can merge with. It becomes a lot harder to do that when you're already a massive company and you're buying other companies because there aren't as many massive companies for you to grow the same percentage. So think about Berkshire Hathaway, for example. It's a massive company that Warren Buffett runs, and he's always looking for this quote-unquote elephant-sized acquisition is the term he likes to use. And that's simply because if you buy some small little company, it's not really going to make a difference to the company's bottom line. He's looking for big, big companies, companies like Burlington Northern Santa Fe or... what's the other one recently? Precision Cast Parts in the past couple of years. So he's looking for big acquisitions. But because Digital Realty, in this case, was a smaller company, they were able to grow very quickly by making this big merger with Telex. And then, as we've talked about in other episodes with real estate investment trusts, growth is mainly funded through debt and equity. And it's mainly achieved by acquisition of new properties, at least based on the companies that we've studied so far. I'm sure there are other nuances to the business model that we just haven't really looked at yet. But this is really the theme that's playing out here, is the company builds new data centers and acquires data centers from existing companies. So that's a key part of their strategy. Now, one of their major competitors over the years has been a company called Equinix. And they had a big move in the last decade where they bought several data centers from Europe from this competitor for over $870 million. So that really gave Digital Realty an international presence, whereas before they were just a company operating exclusively in the United States. So this REIT has a relatively short history, and like other REITs, like I said, it achieves growth primarily through acquisitions. One of the biggest acquisitions that has happened most recently was in 2019, the company purchased Interxion. I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce it. It's I-N-T-E-R-X-I-O-N, Interxion. And that's another data center company that was based in the Netherlands. And they paid $8.4 billion for that company. So this is a massive amount of money. Now, this move is going to help Digital Realty, though, make the move from having around 200 data centers to acquiring an additional 53 that are spread across a whole bunch of different European cities and key markets, cities like London, Paris, Frankfurt, Amsterdam, etc. So again, this is a company that's very aggressively growing internationally at this point. All right, now let's talk about an overview of the business. What does a business actually do? Well, before we get into the specifics of Digital Realty, I think it's first important to understand the nature of data. What does the data industry really look like? And this is not an area where I have a huge amount of background, so I had to spend some additional time doing some research and trying to understand what's really going on here. So let's talk about data. The digitalization of the world, it's been happening for some time. It's been happening for a few decades, really. And it's been happening at a fast rate. And it continues to happen at a fast rate. Consider some simple statistics. So in 2017, a few years ago, there were about 3.4 billion people that use the internet. That's a lot of people. But that's expected to grow to 4.8 billion people by 2022. And that's a 7% annual growth rate. So also consider the fact, to put this in context, that the entire population of the Earth is about 7.6 billion people right now. So that means if this projection is correct, in a few years, over 63% of the Earth's entire population will be exposed to the internet. And this is a trend that I think is just going to continue until, frankly, the entire world is digitalized in some form, except for maybe the most remote places on Earth will have much more limited access still. But especially any sort of urban center, urban area in the world, you're going to see an increasing number of people get connected to the internet. It's becoming an increasingly powerful part of the way that we live our lives as a species, similar to the way that electricity has massively revolutionized the way that we have lived on this earth. So that's just to put some context into it. Now, when you and I listen to a podcast like you're doing right now, when we play a YouTube video or we read an email, you and I are interacting with the internet. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget this. It's so natural, at least, I don't know about you, but for me these days, to be engaged with digital things, like especially for working, for entertainment. It's just such an integral part of life now that I think we often kind of take it for granted and don't think about the amazing nature of what's actually going on. And the internet is frankly just an amazing thing, and we interact with it often, and we often do so all day long. Now, all of this is powered by data. Data is used primarily in just exchanging information. That's what data is. But the way that it used to be stored on hard drives. So that was physically on whatever device you were using. If you were using a desktop computer, you had a hard drive and all of your files, all of your important data, that was stored locally on your device. Now, that used to be the way to go, but now things have changed. Things used to be like that because connectivity between devices was used to be really poor or non-existent. So people needed things to be easily accessed and locally stored on those devices. Now data is increasingly shifting to quote unquote the cloud. So let's explore what that means. The cloud is another way of saying the functionality of the internet. It's not the internet itself, it's more so the functionality of the internet. So the internet itself connects computers together. And an analogy that really helped me kind of crystallize this was that of looking at electricity. When you need electricity, you don't source it from your own home. That is, unless you have solar panels or something like that, which would be pretty cool. You get it from a local utility, and you get it delivered via power lines. Cloud computing is like electricity that you can use to do useful things like powering your home. The internet is the system of power lines that connect everything. You see what I'm saying? So when you use Google Drive or things like Apple iCloud or Slack for communicating with your friends or coworkers, that's using the cloud too. Whenever you stream videos from Netflix, that data is being routed with cloud computing, specifically Amazon Web Services. So the cloud is integral now in the way that we actually access the internet. With all of this digital information moving around, it has to be stored somewhere, right? It doesn't just sit magically in the air somewhere. It actually has to exist and be transferred from one location to another. And that's done through cables and servers and things like that. That's where data centers come into play. Data centers house the servers that are the hardware involved in transferring the data. They are the conduit through which all digital information flows. So the term data center, in a traditional sense, means that a company owns its own set of servers and they have an in-house IT department that manages it. That's becoming less and less the case because there's a lot of costs involved in a company managing their own data. It's now being increasingly outsourced to these cloud service companies. I mean, the most notable one definitely is Amazon Web Services. You have Microsoft Azure and Google Cloud. There's also other players like IBM, Salesforce, and then wholesale, quote unquote, wholesale data centers like Digital Realty. So there's another term that's important to understand here when we talk about the digitalization of the world and how data is stored and moved. It's called co-location. So co-location is effectively a digital economy of scale that you get when you position servers next to each other and allow them, for the sake of speed, to freely share data between each other. And it's the provision of the physical space, the racks, the power, the cooling of someone else's servers. So that's co-location. So in summary, modern data centers and cloud computing companies are to us now what the telecommunications industry was back in the 20th century. I mean, cell towers and other telecommunication technologies still have importance. And in fact, they work with companies like Digital Realty to move data around. But the amount of data and velocity that it moves, that's increasing on a worldwide basis. And that's where these data centers really come into play. Okay, so with that background, let's get back to Digital Realty. So Digital Realty started out essentially as a landlord for data centers. That's where they started, more so from the real estate side. And that's that term co-location. Now, with purchases from the companies that we mentioned earlier, Equinix and Telx, they're shifting more and more towards the technology side of things by providing both cloud and co-location services. So fundamentally, the business provides a mixture of real estate and technology services. So you can kind of see where the hybrid model kind of comes into play. So their customers are other businesses, and this can range from small businesses to large companies, basically people who want to outsource their IT infrastructure. You know, we mentioned how many properties they had when they were first starting out. Well, now they have 225 properties that spread out over 13 countries, which comprise 36 major metropolitan areas. And of those areas, the most important to revenue are in Northern Virginia and in Chicago, respectively 24% and 13% of revenue. So when I read that, I was like, oh, wow, okay, that's kind of interesting. Over a third of the revenue stems from data centers in two regions. And I think that's a little bit concentrated. I would like to see a little bit more diversification there. Now, on a customer basis, I think there is more diversification. There's no single customer that accounts for more than 8% of the revenue. So that was a little more comforting to me. Like, okay, physically, they have these hubs spread throughout the country or concentrated in a few areas. But customer-wise, they have a lot of different types of people, a lot of different businesses that are paying them for their services. So speaking of customers, you probably would recognize some of them. Some of their customers include Facebook, Oracle, IBM, Comcast, Verizon, JP Morgan, China Telecommunication Corp, and on and on and on. So they have a lot of big name customers. And as far as the space that they have relative to their future development, they have over 36 million square feet of lease space. So they're definitely a big player in this space. They've got a lot of assets. And they've got another 6 or so million that's either under active development or they're holding it for future development. So they got plans to increase their capacity even more by a fair amount. So when it comes to companies like Digital Realty, what are they actually selling? So they have a wide range of products and services that other companies can choose from. So if you're a company and you want to store your data, you can come to Digital Realty and say, all right, well, we can go bare bones, which is basically just them providing the physical infrastructure and you provide the servers. You could do that, or you can pay them to set up a private cloud system with them. So if you want complete security, say you have really sensitive information and data that you want to be able to quickly and securely access throughout your company that is spread around the country or the world, you can do that too. Or what's becoming increasingly popular is a hybrid cloud approach. The reason that's becoming popular is it allows the speed and efficiency of using a public cloud for transferring some data, but you also have this private cloud on the side available for organizations with sensitive data. So imagine being a large company and you want to store your data in the cloud. You can use the private cloud for like your really sensitive stuff and then use the public cloud for your not as sensitive data that you just want to, you just want sheer volume and speed for that data. All right, let's talk about the financials. So for the sake of comparison, we're going to compare 2 different years worth of data, one recently in the past and one several years in the past. And that's going to help give us a sense of the trends of this business. Where have they been? Where are they going? And we can actually glean a lot of insight just from looking at numbers between these two time periods. So we'll be comparing 2012 through 2019. First, let's look at sales, the lifeblood of any business. How much money did they bring in? In 2012, Digital Realty brought in just about $1.3 billion in sales. And in 2019, that number increased to just over $3 billion. So that's almost a 14% annual growth rate in sales, which is really strong. I mean, granted, that's basically been fueled by acquisitions, but nonetheless, like, that's pretty strong sales growth, 14%. Now remember, because this is a real estate investment trust, we don't really care about net income that much like we would with a normal company. We care about funds from operations, which kind of takes into account the depreciation and amortization accounting nuances that the net income takes into account. So it kind of removes those, strips out those terms. But funds from operations is a really important metric here. That's basically the profit of the real estate investment trust. In 2012, there were just about half a billion dollars in funds from operations. So pretty strong there. In 2019, that number increased to almost $1.5 billion. So that profit growth actually mirrors the sales growth pretty well. It's a 14% annual growth rate in the funds from operations. Now, how much of this filtered down to shareholders? We need to take a look at the shares outstanding in order to understand that. In 2012, there were 125 million shares outstanding, whereas in 2019, there was just over 200 million shares outstanding. I mean, that's an increase of 67% over the period. That's a lot of dilution. I mean, we've seen dilution before with other companies, but man, that's a lot of dilution. So how does this affect the funds from operations per share? Remember, it's the per share profit that we really care about. In 2012, the funds from operations per share was $4.44. And in 2019, it went up to $6.66. So, okay, not bad. It definitely went up. How quickly did it go up? Well, instead of getting that 14% annual profit growth that the actual company experienced, you as a shareholder would have only gotten 6% annual growth from that. So you definitely got diluted by a fair amount. We'll come back to this in a minute. Let's talk about the balance sheet now. So the company, they do not keep cash on hand. This is definitely a company that's not very cash rich. They only had $56 million in 2012. And over the course of the better part of a decade, they only increased that to about $90 million. So very small cash balance. Let's look at the debt though. So when looking at the debt, I looked at all different kinds of debt. They've got different kinds of unsecured notes. They've got credit facilities that they have opened. Basically, I wanted to see the total borrowing capacity of this business. And that went from just over $4 billion to over $10 billion. So that has more than doubled in the past several years. Again, not surprising given the low interest rates that we're in right now, but still, wow, that's a lot of debt. Now, what about the operating cash flow? We're going to look at the cash flow statement now. So the company made about $500 million in operating cash flow, pretty much the same as the funds from operations. And this number increased about the same as well to 2019, where the company made about $1.5 billion in operating cash flow. So a very strong increase in cash flow. As far as the investing cash, it fluctuates a lot. I mean, sometimes a company spends $2 billion in a year. Sometimes they spend $200 million. It's usually in the billions due to the acquisitions that they make, but this just fluctuates from year to year as the company spends money on redeveloping properties and acquiring competitors' assets. As far as the financing cash flow, again, this fluctuates also a lot depending on how much money the company raises with their debt. So the trends are not as practical here when we look at these numbers. Now let's get to the reason that you invest in a REIT in the first place. You want a dividend, right? You want a high dividend. You want that rental income coming in. And of course, you naturally want capital gains too with an investment of this type, but a dividend is definitely a strong component of the total return here. So let's look at how much money this company paid in dividends. Well, in 2012, they paid over $300 million and they tripled that to over $900 million in 2019. So pretty nice increase in the dividend. But again, it's the per share basis that counts. As far as dividends per share, you and I, if we were shareholders, would have made $2.92 per share in 2012. In 2019, that would have increased to $4.32. Now, this is a 5.7% annual growth rate, which mimics the funds from operations per share growth rate. So management is not overreaching here as far as the payout ratio, how much the dividend takes up out of the entire profit pie. However, the problem is it just increased at such a small rate relative to the rate of the business growth. So that's something that I take issue with. All right, let's talk about the valuation and closing thoughts now. So thinking about this, man, thinking about this data center business, it's just really interesting to me. I am amazed that I have not studied database companies until now. I mean, I've heard it said before that data is the new oil, and I kind of think that's true, although granted, oil is definitely still more important than most people realize. But data, it's scalable. It requires minimal capital expenditures relative to the physical assets that you need. Data is sensitive, which means it can attract a premium valuation because people want to protect it. I mean, just thinking about the nature and concept of data, when I was learning about this company and learning about this industry, I was like, wow, this is mind-blowing. I really have not stopped to consider the powerful, powerful implications of this. And I think I'll probably talk about this more in future episodes because it is such a fascinating concept and it's really shaping the way that we live our lives today. And I think in ways that we don't even truly understand yet, in ways that have profound implications. So I think that data is just a really interesting sector or industry to look at. I mean, many companies out there, they own and create data, right? So think about Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook. You know, you got all the big tech companies that you and I interact with on a daily basis, sometimes on an hourly basis, right? There are people that check their Instagram every hour. You're giving Facebook data every single hour on your usage, everything you click on, your likes, your posts, your tags, how long you stay on a certain screen before you scroll. All of that is tracked, right? Every single thing is tracked. Even the apps like I'm using right now on my phone or my computer, they're all being tracked if they're connected to the internet. And so there's a massive amount of data that's being collected. So for example, Facebook, their main thing is they know someone's social network, right? That's their strength. They know a person's interest. They know what their friends are into. Google has powerful data that profiles what people want to know, especially what kinds of problems that they want to solve. And they have really mastered that as far as advertising. Instead of creating data, Digital Realty manages, secures, and moves the data, which I think is really interesting as a business model because you're not necessarily banking on the fact that people are going to want your specific type of data. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. But in general, people want somebody's data. And so if you can find a way to be that middleman that has the power and the infrastructure to move the data in a way that others cannot, I mean, think about the infrastructure that you would need to actually build a network of data centers that's secure, that's well-cooled and well-powered. You have systems of redundancy built in. That takes a lot of money and a lot of skill. So I think that Digital Realty has something going for it here. But the company itself is doing well, right? I mean, we see solid double-digit top-line growth and bottom-line growth. The acquisitions the company is making, they are indeed making the company money, but at what cost? Instead of seeing your share of the profits go up 14% annually, because of the excessive share dilution that management has utilized to raise these funds, you only saw your share of the profits go up by about 6% annually. Now, that's okay. It's definitely not bad, but it definitely moves this stock from a potentially growth opportunity stock to a slow grower stock from the shareholder's perspective. Now, the share dilution, I might be more okay with it if the company was only using equity to fund its expansion and was more prudent with its debt, but no, management has more than doubled the debt load over the past several years, not to mention there are also preferred shareholders that need to be paid too. There's actually preferred stock that's part of the capitalization structure. So preferred stock, if you don't know, it's kind of like a bond It's not exactly a common stock, but it's not exactly a bond. It's kind of in the middle, but the company has to pay dividends to shareholders who own that too. So it's kind of like a debt. So the business, it's certainly expanding and it's experiencing solid growth, but let's be real, the shareholders are not being taken care of here. Now the price of the stock, it's about $155 per share right now, as of the time that I'm recording this. And based on the funds from operations per share in 2019 that we saw of $6.66, that's a price to funds from operations, basically a PE ratio of about 23. Now, that's irrational. I mean, this is a company that's growing at a decent rate in a fast growing and an exciting industry, but the shareholders are being left behind. Gradually increasing dividends, they're nice to see, but the growth is not as high as it seems once you look beneath the surface. So that's how I feel about Digital Realty. It's got a lot going for it. Valuation is not good. I mean, if this was a business trading at 8x earnings, I would probably be all over it, even with the share dilution, because eventually the acquisitions are probably going to slow down. The share dilution is probably going to slow down as a result. And then the company is going to give higher and higher payoffs to shareholders. So it would be great at a third or two thirds off of what it is now, but it's not. It's trading at 23x normalized funds from operations. So I just don't think the price justifies buying the shares, personally, my personal opinion. But yeah, I think it's fascinating. I'm definitely interested in seeing how other data center companies work, if there are some that are a little more shareholder friendly that are out there. So I'll have to look into that. But that's all I got for you today. Thank you so much for listening to the show. I really appreciate you listening and all of your support. So thank you. If you want to help me out, help the show, you can share it with a friend. Share it with someone who you think would be able to use these episodes and gain some knowledge and insight from it. So I appreciate you sharing the show very much. And also, if you want to reach out to me, you can see me on Instagram at Stock Storyteller. Send me a direct message and say hi. Or you can email me at alex@stockstoriespodcast.com. All right. I'll see you next week. Information presented here on Stock Stories is for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. You and you alone are responsible for your investment and financial decisions. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, or financial advisor that can analyze your specific situation in the context of your goals and circumstances.